I was, I don't know, I assume I was hoping I hadn't seen what I had seen, or I was starting to think more like a doctor. So I went back and checked for pulses, you know, carotid pulses and stuff, and there was no pulse on my wife, and I felt I was getting sick to my stomach, and I was short of breath, and I was dizzy, and my teeth were chattering, 'cause I was cold, and so I didn't know if I was going, I assumed I was going into shock, because I was so cold. That's one of the symptoms of shock. You start getting shaking chills. So I got down on all fours, and I was breathing for a while, and then I realized that I had talked to the operator, and nothing really had happened with her. But, in any case, when I went back to check my wife, I then went to check the kids, and a couple of times I had to, thinking that I was going into shock and not being able to breathe. Now when I look back, of course, it's merely a symptom, that shortness of breath. It isn't, you weren't really that bad, but that's what happens when you get a pneumothorax, you think you can't breathe. And, I had to get down on my hands and knees and breathe for a while, and I went in and checked the kids and checked their pulses and stuff, and, I don't know if it was the first time I checked them or the second time, to tell you the truth, but I had all, you know, blood on my hands, and I had little cuts in here and in here, pointing to his midsection, and my head hurt. So when I reached up to feel my head, you know, my hand was bloody, and so I think it was the second circuit, 'cause by that time I was thinking better, I thought. And I went into that, I went into the bathroom right there and looked in the mirror and nothing looked wrong. I mean, there wasn't really even a cut or anything. So then I went out in the hall and I couldn't breathe. So I was on my hands and knees in the hall and it kept hitting me that really nothing had been solved when I called the operator. And so I went in and this was in the, you know, in the middle of the hallway there. And I went the other way. I went into the kitchen, picked up that phone, and the operator was on the line. My other phone had never been hung up. And she was still on the line and she said, "Is this Captain McDonald?" I said, "Yes, it is." And she said, "Just a minute." And there was some dial tones and stuff. And then the sergeant came on and he said, "Can I help you?" So I told him that I needed a doctor and an ambulance and that some people had been stabbed and that I thought I was going to die. And he said, "They'll be right there." So I left the phone and I remember, going back to look again. And the next thing I knew, an MP was giving me mouth-to-mouth resuscitation and next to my wife. Now I remember I don't know if it was the first or second trip into the bedroom to see my wife, but, I saw that the back door was open, but that's immaterial, I guess. McDonald stopped. Grebner and Ivory and Shaw remained silent. On the radio, Nat King Cole was singing "Ramblin' Rose." "When you woke up," Grebner said, after more than 30 seconds of silence, "there were three men there?" "The first time? You mean when I was on the couch?"
"Yes."
"Right. Well, yeah. Now sir, you know, let me say one thing now." There seemed a new edge of anxiety in McDonald's voice. "You know, when you say something, it sounds cut and dried, but this thing happened. I'm sure it didn't take more than 8 or 10 seconds when I think back about it. You know, I mean, I've been in fights before, and Christ, you think it's an eternity, and, when it's over, it's less than a minute. But I'm sure this was a matter of seconds, and, I'd just woken up, and it was dark, and I think it was three men, right? Because I remember specifically struggling with three people in front of me, and seeing a fourth, seeing the girl. And really, all I saw of her was some long, stringy blonde hair and a big hat."
"You say this man with the sergeant stripes on came toward you. Where did he strike you first? In the head?"
"Right, right. I mean, I was just sitting in bed. I was just getting ready to say something like,
What the hell are you? What's going on here? When I could hear screaming. And really, it isn't a matter of, like, running at me or anything, because it was only a step. The point is, he was closer than the others. And I remember thinking that he was raising something, and I really didn't even defend myself. I mean, it was really too fast. I just sort of sat up. And as I looked and saw these people, he was doing this at the same time. And he hit me. And, I mean, they weren't shouting or anything. There wasn't any, I mean, she wasn't jumping up and down and screaming, you know, kill him. The point was, it all seemed, you know, when you see it like an Easy Rider. I made the mistake of going to see that film. They have all these stop-action things. Well, that's what it seemed like. All I really see is these real fast glimpses of what happened. Captain MacDonald, Shaw said, speaking in a voice so flat and dry that he might have been an airline pilot addressing a cabin filled with passengers. You told one of the other investigators earlier that you were wearing a pajama top that was pulled over your head or something like that. Right. Well, all I know is that, when I was struggling now, after I'd been hit the first time and I was struggling with these guys and my pajama top, I don't know if it was ripped forward or pulled over my head. I don't think it was pulled over my head. I don't remember, actually, like, backing my head through it. But all of a sudden, it was all around my hands, and it was in my way. And I remember that I was holding this thing in my hands, the guy's hand, that I couldn't maneuver very well. My hands were kind of wrapped up in the thing. And as they were punching me, I was kind of using that a little bit, you know, holding it, because this guy I thought was really punching me in the chest, you know, and in the stomach, because I was getting hit across here, pointing again to the midsection of his body. So, in effect, I was blunting everything by, you know, holding this up, and I couldn't get my hands free out of this thing. And I remember I ended up, when I was laying on the floor, I forgot to say that, when I woke up on... It was still all around my hands and everything, and I took it off as I was going in the bedroom. And after I took this knife out of my wife's chest, keeping her warm, you know, to treat shock, elevate the legs and keep them warm. Was Colette alive then? Shaw asked. I don't think so, sir, because, medically, I don't think she could have been, because when I gave her mouth to mouth, I remember distinctly the bubbles were coming out of her chest. She was just lying there, very still, and made no response at all. I didn't take her pulse initially. All I did was see her and, he cleared his throat, take the knife out of her chest and breathe into her mouth, really. So I don't know, but I assume not. She just, you know, I've seen a lot of dead people. Did you try to move her anyplace? Geez, I don't know, sir. I don't think so. I mean, maybe there's a green chair there. Maybe she was leaning against it. I don't remember specifically, no, but, you know, if she was lying a little crooked in my compulsive manner, I might have straightened her out a little bit or something. But I honestly don't remember that. I can't say yes to that. I don't remember moving her. I don't think I moved her body at all. Then Ivory asked, "What part of the hallway were you laying in?" "Originally?" "Yeah." "Down near the end, down near the couch end." "Where did the struggle actually take place?" Grebner asked. Right at the end, right at the, foot of the couch." "Right at the foot of the couch?" "This wasn't a big deal, you know. I wasn't James Bond, like all my readings. It didn't work out the way it's supposed to work out, come charging through. It was just kind of a scene around me that I was grabbing things and holding on, basically. And I remember that at one time when I let go of this club that, you know, I tried to hit a couple of people, and I think I hit the guy with the club once, but, nothing very spectacular, let me tell you." As the morning wore on, the three CID men, With Shaw doing most of the questioning, led MacDonald through his story again, step by step. At Womack Hospital, MacDonald said, though this was not supported by his medical records, it had been discovered that he had a whole bunch of little puncture marks across my abdomen. I guess we ended up with 14 of them, or something like that. These injuries, Shaw said in his dry, sterile voice, were these from these assailants? These people that were in your house? Well, I assume so, MacDonald said. Then, with no change of tone, Shaw let the cat spring from the bag, claws exposed. You didn't do it yourself, did you? No. Almost without pause, though with an even higher pitch of nervousness in his voice, MacDonald continued with a long, rambling explanation of how he'd had to persuade the doctors at the hospital that his lung really was punctured, and that the insertion of a chest tube would be required. For almost 5 minutes he talked nonstop, as if by piling enough other words on top of it, he could smother Shaw's almost gentle but exceedingly ominous query. By the time MacDonald had finished, Shaw had decided to simply let his skepticism lie in the room for a while, smoldering, as he explored other avenues. What were you doing before Colette went to bed? He asked. What transpired in the house that evening? She went to school? Right. The kids and I were lying on the living room floor watching TV, and when they went to bed, I just read for a while. Nothing. I think I was reading one of my mysteries, a Mike Hammer mystery. The book had not been the poetry or philosophy of which MacDonald's sister had said he was so fond, but Kiss Me Deadly by Mickey Spillane. What time did Colette come home? It was a little late. Usually she'd come home about 9:10. I think it was about 9:25 or something. I don't know. She had to drop off one of the girls in the class or something. I'm not... Were the girls still up? No, I think they'd just gone to bed. It's late, I know, but Kimmy stayed up late sometimes with me. So what happened? What transpired on this evening? Nothing spectacular. I mean, she came home and probably had a... Usually my wife would have a little brandy or one liqueur or something while we sat there. You know, it was our time of the day, sort of, and we just usually sat there and watched TV or read or something in the living room together. That's all I remember. I mean, nothing spectacular happened. Did you have a drink that night? I don't remember, honestly. I usually didn't by myself. I might have had a liqueur with her, but I don't remember. Do you know what time this happened? This is what I want, to build events here if I can. Now, she came home at 9:25? Right, roughly then. And the kids were in bed? Right. I remember she came home a little late because she had missed half of the show that's on at 9:00. It isn't Tom Jones. It's some show that's on Monday night at 9:00. Glenn Campbell? We either watch Glenn Campbell or Tom Jones or Johnny Cash. Those three shows during the week. So one of those three, whichever is on Monday night. I remember telling her she had missed the best part of it, and she said she had to drop someone off or something. I stopped at the 7-Eleven or something, and that was it. We didn't do anything unusual. Did you watch any of the late shows? Probably not. I think just up to the news. I turned it off. I usually don't watch TV except the sports or those three shows I was telling you. Well, try to think. Try to think about this. Did you watch the Johnny... Oh, yeah. I was watching Johnny Carson. Johnny Carson? That's right. Did you watch it? Yeah, I was watching Johnny Carson. That's right. Was Colette there with you? No. She started with me. That's right. She started it with me, and she went to bed. She didn't finish. I finished watching the Johnny Carson show, and then she was already in bed by the time it was over. She just watched the beginning. Any particular reason why she didn't stay there with you? She was pregnant, and she She's getting more sleepy, more sleep when she's pregnant.
Okay, well, she went to bed.
What time did she go to bed?
Well, probably 11:30.
No, 12 o'clock, because I remember she started watching Johnny, now that you mention it, the Johnny Carson show with me.
Now, had she changed clothes prior to going to bed?
Yeah. She always comes out and sits around with me in her pajamas. I mean, I say, yeah. This is just 'cause she did it every night. I don't remember her walking in and changing clothes 'cause I was sitting there reading. Like all husbands do, they forget to notice a lot of things. But she always came out and sat down in her pajamas and usually had a liqueur and then go to bed. That was her routine.
So she was in bed by midnight. Did you finish watching the Johnny Carson show?
Right.
And then what did you do?
I read my camera mystery.
What else did you do?
Nothing.
Did you wash dishes?
Yeah, I did. I washed the dishes for her.
Okay. I'm not sharpshooting you now.
No, I understand that. But that's right, I did. I did the dishes.
Once in a while. She hated dishes. The only thing she hated more was ironing, and if she left them, she'd feel terrible the next day, 'cause she'd left them. And she usually leaves them again until night, and they just pile up. So every once in a while, when I'm feeling good, I do them for her, and she thinks I'm a big hero the next morning.
Gradually, almost imperceptibly, the tenor of the questioning sharpened.
I'd like to get down to some other things, Shaw said, that might be a little bit more close to home. I'm sorry, but I have to ask you about them. And that's these. He took out photographs of the weapons that had been found at 544 Castle Drive.
Okay, he said. Now this knife you took out of your wife's chest is curve-bladed. I think it was curved because somebody used it to pry something open or stepped on it or something along that line. Does that seem like something you might have had around the house? A paring knife?
With a curved blade?
Yeah.
A bent blade.
No, I mean, not that I know of, no. I didn't know of anything like that. I don't, my wife had some paring knives. I don't recognize this one in particular. Especially that would have been... I know we didn't have one lying around because, you know... I would throw something like that out. I wouldn't, geez, my wife would keep it forever, but I wouldn't. And if we had a knife with a bent blade, I didn't know about it. I didn't see it, and I don't recognize this.
You say your wife had some around?
Well, sure. She would, you know, she'd cook in the kitchen, and she had plenty of knives laying around.
How many paring knives did she have?
I don't know, quite honestly. Because one of her drawers, she just kept all full of junk. I usually went and used a steak knife. I could never find a paring knife.
There was another one that we found, Shaw said. That would be this one here.
You see, now that's pretty distinctive. It says Old Hickory on there.
I don't know this one. I'd have seen the Old Hickory sign if I had that around. I don't know that one.
Can you specifically say that it is not from your house?
Yeah, unless she got a new knife or something that I didn't know about, but I don't think...
I never saw that, and usually I had a rough idea of what was there, and I would have seen a knife with Old Hickory on it. I didn't see that, I never saw that, so I can say that that's not from my house.
You did some building around there, didn't you?
Right.
Some shelves and that sort of thing?
You saw my abortions.
You had some scrap lumber around there.
Right.
Well, we think that this club that you originally thought was a baseball bat might have come from around the house. In fact, I'll show it to you. I don't know if pieces of wood will mean anything to you from a photograph, but, well, there's paint on it. In fact, we had the idea that you might have used this around the house.
I never saw it.
People use pieces of wood to pry open doors,
right,
and windows,
right,
and for one thing and another. I don't recognize this. Now, I always had some extra lumber laying around outside the back of my house, but I don't... How long is that? It's about 3 feet?
Yes, about 3 feet.
Not specifically, no. I don't recognize this.
Did you make the shelving in Kimmy's closet?
Right. There's a piece of wood there very similar to this. Very similar.
Maybe it was around. I don't specifically recognize it from this, you know, from the photograph.
Did you have an ice pick?
I don't think I had any 2x2s, and this is a 2x2. I know I don't have any 2x2s specifically cut that way. There were 4x4s, I think, and scraps.
Did you have an ice pick around the house?
Shaw repeated, showing MacDonald another photograph.
Is that your ice pick?
No, I didn't have an ice pick.
You did not have an ice pick around the house?
Not that I know of, no.
There was a brief pause. Then Ivory picked up the questioning, his own mind focused on the drops of Jeffrey MacDonald's blood that had been found in front of the kitchen sink.
Did you go into the drawers with the silverware that morning? Ivory asked.
Any time during the morning?
Oh, you mean the morning that it happened?
Yes.
Not that I remember.
Did you clean yourself up in the sink there, the kitchen sink?
I don't think so. I remember washing my hands off, you know, in my compulsive manner, but I thought it was in the bathroom. I don't think I used the kitchen sink at all. I used the phone in there, and maybe when I was talking on the phone.
What is the deepest you went into the kitchen?
Christ, I don't know. I probably just stayed there to talk on the phone. That's all I remember, just talking on the phone.
If we can drift back again, Ivory said. You say during the initial assault you heard screams. Were they just screams or were they...
Words?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like what?
My wife was, saying, he cleared his throat.
Jeff, why are they doing this to me?
Were you still on the couch then?
Right.
Did these screams continue or did they cut out?
I don't know. They asked me in the hospital and I don't remember any cutoff time specifically. They could or could not have continued, you know, while I was wrestling. I really don't remember once this, really the struggle was on. I remember sitting up and hearing them. I remember hearing my wife say, you know, Jeff, Jeff, why are they doing this to me? Help me. I heard her screaming, and I think I heard Christy, Kimmy, the older girl, said, Daddy, saying, Daddy, Daddy, Daddy.
You fought your way to the entrance to the hallway?
Yeah, you asked me that 15 times,
right.
Could you see down the hallway? Did you see anything going on down at the end of the hallway?
No.
What lights were on in the house? Shaw asked. Kitchen light?
Kitchen light was on. I left that on. And usually we left the bathroom light on, the big bathroom in the hallway, so it's shining, so the hallway was a little lit for the kids. And that was, I think that was on too, when they woke up in the night and...
You said when you woke up, you could see your wife, Shaw said.
Well, I could see...
Yeah.
You could see in there?
Right.
You could see your wife. Was that because the light was on in there?
Well, I didn't say that I could see my wife when I woke up.
Well, again, I'm not, no.
Sharpshooting, I just want to know.
When I woke up, the first thing I thought of was, you know, I'm ashamed to say, myself. I mean, when I woke up, I said, Christ, I'm going into shock. And then I realized that everything was quiet, and I started to remember that I heard screaming. So I really didn't even, like, look ahead. I went into the bedroom, and then I saw my wife.
In other words, I didn't lay on the floor and look up, if that's what you mean, and see her.
I remember, as I got up, I was lying there, and I was thinking, Christ, I'm going into shock. And see, that's the first thing that hits.
hits me when I was chilling. You know, my teeth were actually, literally chattering. And the light was on, and it isn't real bright when just the bathroom light is on. Now, at the hospital, they told me those shakes and chills, they weren't from shock. So it must have been from the temperature. It must have cooled off, that's all I can tell you. You know, when I go over it in my own mind, it must have taken a long time for me to get the shakes and chills. My teeth were chattering, and that's a real chill, you know, in contrast to people when they say they're chilly. So if I wasn't in shock, the only thing I can say is, I worked it over 6 million times, is that it must have been cold in that hall there, and I was just cold from the cold. You think it was from the door being open? Shaw asked. Right, that's what I mean. It was real warm when we got there, Shaw remarked. Oh, MacDonald said. Jesus, I don't... Well, the heat's always on. We just turn some of the radiators off if it gets too hot. Okay, this is the point, Shaw said. You woke up, Captain MacDonald, while you were still on your living room couch, and you saw four people, and you heard your wife somewhere. Right. You heard your daughter, right? Right. This is what I can't figure out. Now, I've gone over this hundreds of times in my own mind, you know. Literally all night long, many nights, and I don't... There's so many unanswered questions to me. I assume they came in that back door. They had to come through there. You know, through my wife's bedroom, our bedroom. And I don't understand why, you know, by the time they got to me, that I still heard screaming. Or were there more people involved than four? Four people are a lot of people, Shaw said. Four strangers. I know. In a house your size are a lot of people. I know. There should be... I know. MacDonald laughed. Shaw did not laugh. In my experience, he said, and in his experience, pointing to Grevner, and his, pointing to Ivory, there should be a mess in your house, not... Right. There should be busted furniture and broken mirrors and bashed-in walls and... Oh, well, you people have more experience than I have, MacDonald said, but I wouldn't normally... I mean, I wouldn't necessarily expect that. If someone is attacked when they're sleeping, you might not get broken. There aren't things out of place. Well, I don't know. What? Does this suggest anything to you? Like maybe this group of people knew the inside of the house? Or, yeah, we're being careful, sure. Can you give us any better description of these people that you saw? Shaw continued. I wish I had a Polaroid. You know, this... All I can say is, everyone seemed moderate height. You know, this is ridiculous, I know to you, but everyone seemed normal height. I don't really remember anything distinctive. I don't remember long hair on these people, and this is a little hard for me to figure out. If they were on, you know, LSD or something, they're supposed to be hippies. They're not always. I mean, I've seen a lot of clean-cut special forces guys. How do hippies react? Shaw asked. Not hippies, but people. How do people react when they are under the influence of LSD? Well, anybody. Are they capable of carrying out something like this? Coming to your house out of all these other houses? Well, now you're getting... Now see, you're getting to why they came to my house. If they... Well, I'm not interested in why they came to your house, just for the moment. Let's say it was a matter of fate, okay? All right. It had to be some house. Right. Why not yours? Why not... Right, okay, all right. In other words, can they do this? Can they carry this out, all this business? I've seen many patients that I felt were... Now, you don't always know what they've taken. Well, let's say LSD for the moment. Okay. Well, again, now a person will come in the emergency room and say he's taken LSD, and he's having an acute anxiety reaction, paranoid, and he's, you know, seeing people that he's afraid of or anything. That could be LSD, it could be speed, it could be mesk,
you know, any of this amphetamine-type things, or mescaline. And very often the kids don't know what they've taken, so you have no way of knowing, but they always say LSD. Like I treated one two nights ago at Cape Fear, and this guy was, not two nights ago, last week, and this guy was capable of anything, I'm sure. He was extremely agitated and wild, and all you had to do was move and, you know, he'd jump up and he was very paranoid. You know, people were attacking him and he had to defend himself. Okay, let's branch away from that for just a minute, Shaw said. The people that are taking amphetamines, uppers. Right. We've got four of them now that we know about in your house. They're on something, we think. This girl was talking about acid. Right. LSD, right. It could be, as you say, anything. Could be even peyote buttons, for all we know, right? Right. Well, I don't know what that means. Yeah, I've heard about them. They're excited. They're doing something that's emotionally exciting to them. They'd be jumping around wild, wouldn't they? There'd be a lot of hyperaction here. Is this correct? Yeah, I agree with you. Most of the people I've seen on these drugs, you know, they're not steady and cool by any means. Usually they're paranoid and anxious, and when they do something, it's sort of in a frenzied kind of way, isn't it? Well, I don't know. That's kind of I don't know. The other problem I have, Shaw said, is a motive. Right. We've got to establish a motive for this thing, and I don't see one. There's nothing even missing from your house, not even vandalism. Right. Captain MacDonald, there's nothing missing. You have a lot of things in your home that people would like to steal. They were nice, I know. You have a lot of drugs in your house. I know. Why? Oh, I just got something of everything in case anyone ever asks me. Johnny on the spot, you know. Very often I'd suture people, and I took care of half the neighborhood, you know, and nothing there was controlled. I was careful about that. I didn't have any controlled drugs or anything like that. Everything was stuff there wouldn't be any problem with, and no one should be after for any reason. And I just had, like, for instance, if we were going to go on a camping trip, I was all ready to make up a nice little kit with, you know, all the possibilities involved. But that was the only reason. All this came about when the 3rd Special Forces disbanded, and they had boxes and boxes of stuff they were just going to burn, and I thought that was stupid. So I just took a couple of bottles of everything and was going to make up my own aid kit, you know, for my car and camping and stuff. But I know it looked a little excessive, I'm sure. It looked more than a little excessive, Shaw said, glancing at a list which showed that, among many other drugs, syringes, and disposable scalpel blades, MacDonald's hall closet had contained 18 50-milligram vials of liquid thorazine, an antipsychotic drug often used to sedate unruly mental patients. It looked real excessive, frankly. I'm being frank with you, as you're being frank with me, I hope. Yeah, well, were you sending these things to people? Just my mother, my in-laws. Diet pills, thyroid medicine, blood pressure pills. Okay, were you sending anything to anybody around here that would suggest? Shaking his head to mean no. Can you give us any help along this line at all? Geez, I wish I could. I just can't imagine that I've ever offended anyone enough, unless they're psychotic. And then that one person commits at least 3 others to his cause. At least, right, right. Other people, and to have no one break down, you know. No one come forth and feel bad or read the newspapers and say, Jesus, I know of, you know, I know some people and I saw them Tuesday morning and they were all bloody, or something. So I agree with you. I don't know. I'd sleep a little easier, I'll tell you that. Captain MacDonald, Shaw continued, having decided to further quicken the inquiry's pace. There are some other things we found in the house. Some other questioning we have. We'll present them to you, and if you can explain them, fine. If you can't, we'll just have to worry about that. But I want to get with you now on this thing because this is like money in the bank to you. This is real important to you. For example, let's start with one thing. This pajama top you were wearing, okay? We've taken this thing and we've examined it under laboratory conditions. We know what it's made of. We know what kind of fiber is in it. We know what kind of threads are in it. Right. Okay. Now we have found fibers and threads in various places in the house. And one of the most puzzling things to me personally is that we found fibers from this jacket under Colette's body, strung out under her body. And I'm interested in how they came to be there. Shaken off? Or, I don't know, maybe, do these things shed? Are they laying all around the house? I mean, I don't know. You mean they're big fibers? Yeah. Not microscopic. Not a fuzz, Ivory interjected. Not a fuzz? No, Shaw said. Fibers and threads. I don't know. I can't answer that. All right, Shaw said, moving along a little bit further with this thing. How does it happen that the pocket from this pajama top has a little bit of your wife's blood on it? Very, very minute amount. But it's laying in the bedroom. The rest of it, the jacket, is soaked with her blood. I laid it over her. And with Kimmy's blood. Now, how does that happen? Well, I'm sure I had blood all over my hands from everyone when I was checking for pulses and stuff. Yeah. And, when I went back to see my wife, I don't know how much, Jesus, I don't know. If I had blood on my hands and I went back and touched, this pajama top, could it have gotten on it from that way? I mean, I had blood all over me, you know? I mean, I checked carotid pulses in everyone, and I'm sure I got some blood on me from everyone. And I went back in to see my wife again. Like I say, this is important to you, Shaw said, and I want you to understand what we're talking about. We've got your pocket in one location, and it had a couple of spots of blood on it. Colette's blood. The rest of the pajama top, including the area beneath where the pocket had been, is drenched with blood. But the pocket was way over in another part of the bedroom, away from Colette. Could it have been torn off me? I mean, in the struggle, and someone else dropped it? That's what we think, that it was torn off during the struggle. But we have to find a way to get it to the bedroom. I don't know. Maybe someone, maybe it was hanging on, and when I walked in, it fell off. You know, I mean, there's a couple of ways I could picture it. Either say that when we were struggling, it was torn off. Okay, we'll say that. And the person on the way out the door dropped it. Is that possible? Well, anything is possible, Shaw said. Right, okay. Some things are less possible. There was a short pause. Then Shaw said, in addition, we found fibers from this jacket in Christie's room and in Kimmy's room, both. Holy Christ. Again, I'm not sharpshooting you now. No, I know. But you told us that you took this off in the master bedroom. Right. Well, now, how about my hands and stuff? Could they be coming from my hands as I was taking it off and walking down the hall? I don't know. You know, when I mean, couldn't it have been attached to the hairs on my arm or something and, you know, ripped in the struggle and fall off? Well, Ivory said, we're not talking about a, say, stray thread or a fiber here and there. We're talking about a profusion. Well, it doesn't make sense to me. A profusion, I don't know. All I can say is that I don't know what this, you know, how ripped this jacket looks. I don't even remember it, to tell you the truth. I just remember taking it off my hands. But if it was ripped up, it seems to me the threads could be on them and on me. It could have fallen on them. That's all I can honestly say. Now, in addition to all this, Shaw said, confusing the names of MacDonald's two daughters, we found a fiber from that jacket under Kimmy's fingernail, and it had blood on it, which would indicate somewhere she... Under Kimmy's? She got her... I don't know, it's pretty obvious what you're, MacDonald laughed. I don't know. Well, Shaw said, this is why, Captain MacDonald, we've got these specific things we've got to talk about.
Right.
Because you are the only person who knows what happened in that house. Listen, I know all about that, and, look, all... Jesus Christ. All I can say is that it seems to me these fibers in a struggle could have gotten on everyone, and I don't know. I mean, obviously, I wish... I can't give you the answers specifically. All I can do is make conjectures. Abruptly, Shaw shifted direction. At any point during the night, he said, during this checking of your family before the military police arrived, did you wear a pair of gloves?
Did I wear a pair of gloves?
Yeah, you.
Oh, yeah, to do the dishes.
What kind of gloves were they?
She usually had two pairs laying there, a yellow thick dish glove and a pair of my surgeon's gloves. I don't know which ones I used, I don't remember.
But did you use gloves to wash the dishes?
Yeah.
Okay. After you realized, after you had been attacked yourself and you woke up and you realized that there had been harm done in this house, did you wear gloves at any time?
No.
Not to take pulses or anything like that?
No.
Okay. Well, we have a lack of blood in some places where there should be. Captain MacDonald, a lot of blood. There should be a lot of blood on the telephone in your bedroom, and there should be a lot of blood on the telephone in your kitchen, but there isn't. The phone is down. It's off the hook. Where's the blood? Did you wipe your hands off someplace?
Maybe on my wife's nightgown or something, or when I was checking the pulses, I was...
What are my pajama bottoms like?
I don't remember. Maybe my hands were relatively dry when I picked up the phone, but I don't...
Not before the first call, unless it was on the rugs or, my wife, on the nightgown and stuff, you know. But I don't know.
You've worked in the emergency room a lot, Shaw said.
Right.
It's your profession.
And you don't get your hands full of blood and wipe them off and not contaminate what you touch. You get blood on what you touch.
Right.
Unless it's dry. I mean, you know, if... Now when I woke up on the floor, if I had been there for a while, it could have been dry and not leave too much.
It wasn't dry when we got there.
Okay, that shoots that down. I don't know.
You know, Shaw continued, I've also been thinking about this big wet urine spot there on the bed. Was there a lot?
This happened all the time, MacDonald interrupted. That's not unusual, you know. Every night, Christy was in there, just about every night. I tried to tell my wife that the way to do it is to keep her in bed one night, even though she cries. We did it with Kimmy, and it worked. She never again came in, and there was no problem. But Colette, you know, said it was worth getting up for 1 minute every night, rather than to have to go through two or three nights of yelling and screaming. So she usually always came in. She was 2 and a half, and still had a bottle, you know.
That's kind of unusual, isn't it?
We were real easygoing, and if Christy wanted a bottle, well, we decided, let her have a bottle. No big deal. Kimmy had a bottle a long time, and she was fine. I mean, there didn't seem to be any harm, and she was happy. She was a good kid, didn't have any problems.
Christy was pretty well taken care of, it seems like.
Well, they were both taken care of. I don't think either of them were really favored. They were totally different. Kimmy was real, you know, effeminate and a real female. And Christy was a tomboy, you know. They were both totally different, but I don't think either of them, you know, we loved them both for different things. Equally, I'm sure. You could yell at Christy more because it didn't affect her. You couldn't yell at Kimmy. I mean, she got very upset if she thought, you know, you were disapproving of her. What kind of class was Colette in? Shaw asked. What the heck was the latest one? I don't know. Something literature. I mean, I really don't know. She had just gotten an A in her 17th century English. I don't know. She was an English major, and it was some kind of literature course. Was she after her degree? Yeah, in English. She was going to end up, when I got to Yale, she was going to try to get into Yale or a college nearby. Yale is accepting girls now, and she only needed about a year more. She had 2 years at Skidmore, and a whole lot of courses since we've been married, different places. And she was going to try to get a bachelor's in English. To what end? I don't know. I suppose that she would have liked to have ended up being some kind of an instructor, preferably in a college atmosphere, you know, wherever I was. I was probably going to stay at a university to practice, and she would just piddle, you know, be an instructor, kind of a part-time thing. I didn't want her working with the kids, and she didn't want to work very much. And it was nice, you know, having her around, taking care of the kids and taking care of me.
Shaw intruded upon this reverie. Kimmy was in your bedroom, he said, and she got hurt in there.
She got hurt?
Yes.
You mean that night?
That's what I'm saying.
Unless she went in. Now, she hardly ever did anymore. Very rarely would she leave her bed. She was, you know, at the point now where she slept in her own bed and stayed there. You know, very rarely would she go in with Colette and myself. That was like once a month that occurred.
If she had heard something, Shaw asked, and been awakened, was she the type of child that would go and investigate to see what was going on?
Well, Christy would. Even at 2.5, probably. But I'm not sure about Kimmy. Kimmy was like a, you know, she got bucked off the new pony I just got them once, and she wasn't. It took her a while to get back on, you know what I mean? She wasn't a take charge, and that, I don't know, that's conjecture, but Kimmy was, she was real effeminate and real soft and gentle, and I don't know. But if she had a nightmare, for instance, the only parable I can draw, if she'd wake up crying from a nightmare, she'd just sit there and yell until Colette came in, whereas Christy would come charging into the bedroom and dive into the bed. You know, a whole different way of doing something. If Kimberly heard screaming, I would doubt if she would go and investigate that. She's bright and curious, but she's also a very dependent type child, you know?
You don't think she would?
Well, she might have. How can you tell, really, what a 5-year-old girl would do? If you had said to me, what would I expect? Christy, yes. Christy would go charging anywhere, partially because she's young enough, so she doesn't have any fear yet. But Kimmy was always different. She was always, you know, you had to take her by the hand, except in academic things. I mean, she was the one that came home and knew how to read and write way too early and stuff like that. But like she'd get pushed around by other kids, whereas Christy would defend her, believe it or not. Kimmy would come home crying and Christy would run over and crack someone. So, geez, that's the first time I heard that. I hadn't heard anything about Kimberly's being injured in the master bedroom. Umph.
There was a long pause.
Now, I did hear them both screaming, MacDonald said. So I think I'm positive it was Kimmy. Definitely it was Colette, because she's the only one who would call me Jeff, and I know her voice. I'm sure the other one was Kimberly. See, you know, but I didn't know that, what you've just said.
Don't read anything into this, Shaw said. But if it comes to this, are you willing to take a polygraph in reference to what we've talked about this morning?
Sure, absolutely.
Well, that's fine. We wanted to get that out in the open. You realize you don't have to.
Sure, that's fine with me.
We might ask you to, just to clear the air here. It was by now 11:20 a.m.
How would you like to have a cup of coffee? Shaw asked.
I would. We've talked a long time.
Bill, will you take care of that? Shaw said to Ivory.
Show the captain where the coffee is.
The voice of Jeffrey McDonald. Fort Sam Houston became kind of a fun time, to my surprise. I thought it would be fairly difficult at first, but it ended that we were assigned to motel rooms rather than barracks. And I met this doctor from Williams College, who's now an orthopedic surgeon on Maui, and he and I ended up sort of hanging around together for the 6 weeks of training at Fort Sam Houston. We had a very different lifestyle than I initially thought. We started working out together, along with a veterinarian whose name I totally forget, which had always been my custom, even through medical school and internship, to try to get some running in at least several times a week and some exercise, occasional handball or basketball. Fairly early on, they had this sort of careers day where they put all of us in an auditorium and brought in different specialists from branches of the service and tried to get you to sign up. And I remember these mostly turkeys came across the stage and gave their little talk, and there was really nothing very exciting. And then a full colonel, a bird colonel, came out with his green beret on and his dress uniform with jump boots and all his medals over his left chest and his wings on, and he gave about a 2-minute talk. Basically, what he said was, well, you guys can just sign up and treat a 50-yard long line of malingering GIs who don't want to be there and who hate the war, and half of them just have VD and the other half don't have anything. Or you can spend 2 years doing something really valuable. You can join up, learn how to jump out of planes, become airborne, a paratrooper, and then work with the best troops on Earth, the United States Green Berets. He said, if you have any guts for that kind of thing, see me. And he walked off the stage. Well, this friend from Williams and I, we kind of looked at each other and said, Jesus, that sounds pretty neat. We never even thought of that. And we both laughed and said, let's go. And needless to say, we were the only two out of about 400 people who went to see him. This colonel, Colonel Himmer, his first name was Einar. He had escaped, I think, from Germany in World War II. He may have been Norwegian or Swede, but I think he was German. And he escaped during World War II and came to the Allied side and ended up going back to medical school in the 40s or 50s and ended up in the Green Berets. In any case, he was a tall German with a German accent, and he still had this old Prussian way of dealing with officers and men, and we were impressed with him and with the drama and the possibilities of jumping out of planes and being a Green Beret. This really turned both my friend and I on, and we went away, and as I remember, we went out and worked out. It was about 106 degrees in San Antonio in July, but we ran a couple of miles together and did our chin-ups and push-ups and sit-ups and whatnot, and felt pretty good about the possibility of becoming Green Berets. And I remember I called Colette later that night or the next day and sort of announced, rather than asked, that I'd been offered this chance to go airborne and to go to paratrooper school and join the Green Berets. And I remember there was a little silence at the other end of the phone. My mom was there at the other end too, I believe. She was with Colette, or Colette came next door to see my mom as soon as I called. In any case, I remember there was a little silence, and then Colette's next question was, well, why in the world would you want to jump out of airplanes and be a Green Beret? And I must have been a little, you know, excited or up about it, but I was very enthusiastic, and I told her that they were the best troops in the world, and we'd learn different things as well as doing the medical work. We'd learn patrolling and long-range reconnaissance and jumping out of airplanes and demolitions and small weapons fire and all this stuff. And I explained to her how instead of wasting 2 years in a sick call line treating not very sick people, this way I had a chance to work with these incredible troops, and if I went to Vietnam, I might even go as a Green Beret physician. Colette was uncomfortable about my becoming a Green Beret, but she also respected me, you know, for making a firm decision, and she sort of, you know, she put her faith and her trust in me. Also, to be honest, this colonel had told us that if we passed the physical test and signed the right papers and were willing to go to airborne school, we could have our orders changed from Vietnam to Fort Benning, Georgia, and we would get orders from Fort Benning, probably to JFK Center at Fort Bragg for Green Beret status. And this was the thing she sort of latched on to, and then I sort of used as the trump card, I guess, that I was being taken off orders for Vietnam. And then I sort of realized how this was the first time that I ever really understood that Colette was upset that I might be going to Vietnam. I had always been kind of casual about it, and a little cavalier, but at that point, that phone call brought me to a realization that Colette, and therefore probably my mom and dad were, I'm sorry, not my dad, but my mom, were upset about me going to Vietnam. So therefore, that became the topic of conversation, that joining the Green Berets was getting me off orders to Vietnam, but that was not at all my intention in joining. As a matter of fact, I fully expected to go to Vietnam as soon as I got the Green Beret. And later on, as a matter of fact, I talked to two of my commanding officers and asked to go to Vietnam on two different occasions, neither of which were fully discussed with Colette. At the time, it wasn't, I felt, appropriate. Now, in retrospect, of course, that's a decision I probably should have shared a little more widely with her, but I saw it as part duty and part something I wanted to do. So we were down in Fort Sam Houston, which was clear and sunny and hot and dry, and we had these few little physical tests. I went and eventually took my test after working out for, I think, about another week with my friend from Williams, really hard every day. We went and took the test in our fatigues and boots, and we both passed with flying colors. At Fort Benning, during my paratroop training, I was proud of working toward earning my wings, and of course, my first jump is something I will never forget. I remember very clearly going out the door. I was definitely, you know, scared, but as I got closer to the door, my fear seemed to decrease. They didn't have to push me. And getting a sense of confusion as the air hit you and you spun around. I remember that the feeling of being tossed and turned was much more than I was prepared for, but I also remember what an incredible rush it was as you looked up and saw your chute open above you. It was sort of like, you know, your heart had stopped for a minute and then started beating again. Relief floods through you, this incredible relief, and next an exhilaration that you've actually done it. You've jumped. A lot of guys gave out a tremendous whoop as we were heading on down towards the earth. The sky was full of new paratroopers, and you could hear the yells of exhilaration up and down, guys giving Geronimos and war whoops and, "I made it!" And, you know, even picking up on some of the yells that the instructors had us screaming while we were running all through airborne school about going to kill some Charlie Kong. I'll never forget that exhilaration. The day after my airborne graduation, I flew out of Fort Benning. I believe I had a couple of days and I flew to New York, and I remember how neat it was to get off the plane at JFK and have jump wings on my dress army greens. Still a regular army hat, officer-style hat, but I had jump wings now. And the casual army hat, the soft army hat, had a different patch on it now because I was airborne, and I remember how neat I felt. Now, arriving at Fort Bragg, it was actually the best time of year for weather. The fall at Fort Bragg is clear and pretty, the sky is blue and the pine trees are all nice, and there's a lot of green grass that still hasn't turned brown for the winter. And Fort Bragg was the home of the Airborne, the 18th Airborne Corps and the 82nd Airborne, as well as the JFK Center for Special Warfare, the Green Berets. So it was, you know, an elite base with a lot of elite troops, the 82nd Airborne being better than most of the ground troops, and the Green Berets being allegedly the best of all. In addition, fairly soon after I got there, I was able to arrange for the housing at 544 Castle Drive, and Freddie drove Colette and the kids down, and we moved into the house. Moving in, you know, moving, I think, is always traumatic, but it went very well. Colette was happy to have had some time with Freddie, I think, and the kids were... It was going to be a super setup for us, because the school was on post and was good, and we would have no trouble getting babysitters, and we had an income and a reasonably sized house. Each of the kids had their own bedroom. We had our own bedroom. It was officers' quarters, and to us it was great. Also, being together again. You know, despite the bachelor atmosphere at Fort Sam Houston and a little bit in Fort Benning, it was really nice to be back with Colette and the kids. My job seemed relatively easy and lots of fun. I was getting in a lot of jumps and learning some neat things. I was able to get my workouts in. Right after Thanksgiving, I started working out with the boxing team and still had this great time to be with the kids and Colette. Also, I was not on orders for Vietnam, and Colette was very relieved about that. Once we were settled, though, I went to see my commanding officer, Colonel Kingston, and told him that I didn't mind going to Vietnam, and that, as a matter of fact, I kind of wanted to go. Bob Kingston was the guy who was in charge of the 3rd Special Forces when I first got to Fort Bragg, and he made me his group surgeon 1 or 2 weeks after I arrived. In other words, I was the main doctor under Colonel Kingston. I had heard all the legends about him. He's the guy who was behind the lines in North Korea. He was a